welcome, everybody, to the July edition of In the Now.
Now.
JP?
What's up, man? How you doing, Flip?
Pretty good. Demetrius?
Yo.
What's going on?
I'm sitting here.
Wow. VR?
Wow!
Yeah. Wow. All right.
It's a good day.
It's a good day. How was your guys' 4th of July?
Rocking.
I worked.
As always.
You worked?
I worked.
Hey, we had a show that night.
Yeah, I worked and sweated a lot.
Yeah, we played a show and nobody was there. It was kind of sad.
Yeah, I saw a lot of strange, really whacked up people while watching a lot of pyrotechnics.
So you're in your room?
My Christmas.
You know, have you guys
noticed?
Yeah,
that's a standard weekend for me.
Have you guys noticed this year it was more about, like, who had the biggest fireworks show instead of, like, our celebration of independence?
Yeah, I've been actually rather concerned about that over the years, that we've lost the actual true meaning of what the fireworks are as a essentially reenactment of a battle.
You could say that for any holiday.
They should start pointing the fireworks at people. That would reenact a battle.
And that'd be kind of fun. That'd bring about a whole new sport.
It'd
be
kind of
televised.
Like
people on death row.
You just like run out there with some body armor on and just like head off the fireworks.
All I know is it wasn't half as lame as a Tempe's New Year's celebration has become. Well, giant Tostitos.
Well, instead of like for Halloween bobbing for apples, it'd be dodging bottle rockets.
Wow. Yeah. And potato guns.
Oh.
And nuclear warheads? Or not?
I hope not. All right.
And Doritos.
And sparklers for
the
all.
The 3D Doritos.
3D Doritos.
You could dodge those.
How are you supposed to dodge a 3D Dorito?
That's
the question.
Anything.
Right there. I don't even understand. All right.
I just don't know.
Well, we got a lot of stories tonight. Head off to the first one here. This is just a brief snippet that the Department of Defense adopts Star Office. They've got, which is good for the open source community and good for the Linux community, because this runs off of Linux or even Solaris. They bought 25,000 units of Star Office 5.2. So that's...
And the report was correct. There's a few other countries considering doing that as well, like Germany and Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think the government did it. Said it didn't cost them anything, since obviously it was
free.
Yeah, and they already had a consultation deal with Sun, so that was a good way to go for them.
Free software?
Pay taxes for the government to buy Windows when they don't have to.
Free software is good software.
Yes.
As long as it's been tested. Beta tested. Well, if we're going to talk about 25,000 copies of Star Office, let's talk about the new registration process for Windows XP, which... a lot of people aren't liking really well. I'm going to read the article, and then I'll talk about some of the things I know offhand. Okay. This is how the activation of Office XP, and I think for Windows XP as well. Here's how Windows XP activation will work. You will install Windows XP. The software will notify you that you must activate the product within 30 days. You can perform this activation almost instantly over the Internet or call a toll-free number. In either case, the company will create a record of your machine and link it to a serial number of the copy of Windows you install. If you don't activate Windows within the specified period, it will cease functioning except to remind you to activate it on a new PC with Windows XP pre-installed. Pre-installed, or even if you buy it yourself and install it. If you try to install the same copy of Windows on a different PC, you'll be asked to activate again. Only this will act. This time the activation will fail, and you'll be advised that it's illegal to install one copy of Windows on multiple machines, and it'll tell you to buy another copy. The second installation of Windows will stop working. And then the article questions some things I question as well. Well, what if your PC malfunctions and you have to reinstall Windows XP? Well, you have to explain the situation to Microsoft and beg the company to allow you to activate it again. Because, you call them up and they'll think you're going to try to pirate it. And you're saying, well, you'll try to give an excuse and try to social engineer your way around it. What's more, Windows will keep monitoring your setup and check to see if it's still running on the same machine. If you make major hardware changes, the system could disable Windows and force you to check in with Microsoft in the mistaken belief that the program has been transferred to another computer.
Microsoft, can I have permission to use this product that I paid for?
No.
Thank you.
Microsoft, am I okay to shut the computer off now?
No. We need to grab your information and download it.
I want to go to the bathroom.
No.
No.
Microsoft, why do you have a deep voice? Shut up.
This is the voice of Microsoft. One journalist reported that his copy of XP suddenly went into reduced functionality mode and insisted he activate it again while he was using it on an airplane. That just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, you paid for the software. What's the hassle? I mean, you already bought something that was overpriced to begin with. And
Well, it sounds like you're not actually paying for the software. You're paying for the privilege to install it once.
Which is the ego that Microsoft seems to have, is that they're more of in control of your software than you are. But
did
you
we
own
talk
it.
About those tags last week that will allow them to like put links in your page that you don't even want to put in there? Or last month did we talk about that?
Yeah, the .NET services.
Yeah, those are crazy.
And then there's also something called smart tags.
Yeah, smart tags.
Smart tags are something that like smart tags are kind of a benefit. These are a little different than the other ones. I know somewhat about it. There may be other things that I don't know. But smart tags is like if you have a document and you want to like have something like stock quotes in there, and what it will do is smart tags will like link to something like on an internet site or something like that, and like your document will update with like you know stock quotes or whatever you have that needs to be updated in some service provided by that on the internet. So
well, there was one feature which since a lot of people got PO'd about it, they've since disabled it or decided not to make it a standard feature. But it would allow Microsoft to say anybody who's using Internet Explorer, like they go to a certain your page, and then Microsoft could say, okay, wherever we have the word cheese, we can go to a Microsoft-sponsored cheese page, and that link would automatically be on your page without you inserting it there. So that basically they can make money off your page without your permission. But a lot of people got mad about it, so they said they disabled it, even though they're saying they still may use it in a future Windows version.
Yeah, there's also a new licensing thing that they're trying to do is when you buy like Windows XP or Office XP and they push back off of it, which you would have to pay a monthly fee to use the software. And then if you didn't pay that monthly fee, it deactivates. Actually, there's a software that actually does this already, and it's called Rivet, and it's a CAD software, and you pay monthly, and the way it works is that any new versions, this could be a benefit or a non-benefit. Any new versions that come out, you get it for free, you know, because you're paying every month. So it's like a concurrent thing. You're paying along with the development of the software. Hopefully, you're not paying too much. You'll get all the updates. You'll get technical support, so you can call anytime while you're paying your monthly fee. You can call anytime and get technical support. You can get training. You know, I don't know if you go to a certain place and train or they'll have somebody come out to you and train. And it seems to be working okay with them, and people have accepted that. But a lot of people are getting pretty upset with Microsoft because it's a much more complicated issue. There's all these different pieces of software you're going to buy, and then it's maintaining all these monthly fees. And who knows if these monthly fees are going to be astronomical and worth the end price. Like, you know, you can, like the company I'm working at, we're still in Office 97. And, you know, we've gotten to the point where, you know, we're ready for the next upgrade. But they've had Office 97 for quite some time. And they already paid
since
for
it. 97, I believe.
Yeah, at least 97. And they paid for it then, and they lasted, you know, this many years off that original price. To me, that's a lot better. You know what I mean? Like, if you don't need the new update, if you don't need the technical support all the time, basically you're just putting more money out of your pocket when you don't, you know, when you don't need to, when you can, you know, I just don't think many people are going to accept it, and it's actually been something that, you know, a lot of people felt the same way, and they pushed back on it.
Yeah, it's basically another step towards just having a huge network, and everybody's got a dummy box, and you just pay for, like, a monthly fee, and it's got all the software on there, which, I don't know, it's good or bad, depending on how you view it.
Well, basically, I mean, you could have the same thing on a grander scale. Like, you know, there'll be a button, you know, like, everything will be an interface for, like, you know, for JP. And, like, okay, here's JP's operating system, like, some person could control the whole thing. Here's JP's operating system. Let's see. He's not paying. I'm going to turn that off. Let's see. There's JP's water. He didn't pay that, too. Okay, I'm going to turn that off. Just a hit of a button. There's JP's power. Let's see. There's JP's, you know, credit account at Circle K to get all of his Mountain Dews. I'm going to turn that off, too. So it's, I don't know. Integration is good, but not when everything's integrated. I'm not really into that.
Yeah, it gives the higher-ups too much control.
Yeah, too much control. And the selling point is that they're making it easier for you. But I think in the end, you're paying more out of pocket. So.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely why they're doing it.
it's an exchange, privacy, convenience. You can only basically have one or the other. Like, you give away one, you get more of the other. So whichever one you value more, I guess.
So which basically, in this society, which would make you want to become some, like, rich millionaire and screw other people over so you can have some big company because you know your privacy will be lost, so you might as well be the guy taking other people's information instead of having yours taken. I mean, I think that's the thinking that would eventually turn into, which would turn into, like, a corrupt human being. It'd be an environment you wouldn't enjoy being in. I mean, you know, like, you seem like there's this whole path that you're supposed to take throughout your life now. That's like, okay, first you're stuck in school, you go through school, you get out, you're stuck into the system where you have to start working. And then if you don't start working, if you don't start paying all these different things that are, you know, that they now have, like, more closely monitored, just like this, the Windows, where you put two copies on one machine. Like, those kind of freedoms, I think, where someone would maybe put two copies of Windows on, you know, two different machines because they didn't want to go out and pay for another one, is something where people are already taking so much. I mean, you know, when you make a third out of your money, you take home a third of your money throughout your whole life. You know, the government takes it, somebody else takes it, somebody else takes it. People, you know, companies will charge you for, like, insurance companies. They'll, like, charge you documentation fees. You know, like, if you go buy a car, they'll charge you processing fees. They'll charge you fees for them to do their job for you. And I think, you know, little places where, little gray areas where maybe if you install, like, your operating system on two machines, it's kind of like your peace of mind that you still have something like that. But now if you have Big Brother over your shoulders at all times, it's going to make you a very disgruntled person. I think it's going to make you more rebellious.
Speaking of Big Brother, why don't you tell them about the rental cars?
Can I interject something on that same issue? I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said, those who give up a little bit of freedom for a little bit of safety deserve neither.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so if they allow themselves to do it, then that's their own fault. But those who actually fight it and see it are the ones who's going to come out in the end just a little bit better.
To me, basically, you just have to be humble. And I think if you read the Bible and you believe in the Bible, a lot of things in the Bible explain how to live in a society like that and how to survive. And, you know, if you think you need, like, material things and it's going to be a part of this whole process to get those material things for your happiness, you don't really have to have your happiness by participating in the society. If the society doesn't work for you, then you don't have to participate in it. And I'm not saying that in a threatening way. I'm saying in a positive way that, you know, go to another society and support that one, or you know, or fight to help this society, or, I don't know, even try to create your own society. So,
well, still, all those things still take you buying into them. And the concept of Wu Wei from Taoism is choosing the action which requires taking no action. So by not buying into it, you are essentially keeping yourself free from it.
Exactly. Okay, well, this next story is another Big Brother story, and might shock a couple of people. I think they...
very scary.
Yeah, very scary. I think they... Yeah, they do say the company that is doing this. Okay, here's a bit story about this guy named Jack Turner. Jack Turner is taking on Big Brother to small claims court. Turner's taking his own car. Big Brother's driving a rental. Wait. Turner's taking his own car. Okay. Big Brother's driving a rental. Basically, that means that Big Brother's a rental company, and he's taking his own car in because he's angry about what I'm going to tell you next. The rental outfitted with a high-tech device, this guy rented a car, that tracks your every move. One that records your speed. One that enables rental car agents to rip off unsuspecting drivers. Turner's really suing Acme Rent-A-Car on Wally Avenue in New Haven for cozying up with Big Brother. He's trying to recoup a $450 charge for allegedly speeding on his way to Virginia in an Acme minivan. The van was equipped with a global positioning system, or GPS, which transmits data via satellite. It clocked him doing speeds of in excess of 90 miles per hour on three separate occasions, according to the court papers. The internal device did, but the cops didn't. When Turner signed Acme's rental agreement last October, he didn't notice that the warning at the top of the contract had read, vehicles in excess of posted speed limit will be charged a $150 fee per occurrence. All our vehicles are GPS equipped. Little did Turner know that this van was equipped with a sophisticated device that called Air IQ. Someone's got to tell me, what is it their business anyways to make sure that you're driving slow?
That's insane, dude.
It's their property, though. You're borrowing their car.
You're paying for their privilege.
Yeah, you're actually renting it from them, which, unless...
It's really, they're not going to get in trouble if you speed. You get in trouble if you speed.
Yeah, but it's one of those new, like,
to me,
surprisingly, like, it's everywhere now where you're paying double for something.
Okay.
It's like you always pay to see a movie, but now they show commercials before even the preview's going.
Okay.
You're paying to watch commercials. It's the same thing.
Here's the breakdown. Is that you rent the car, it is their car. Now, when you rent the car, you actually pay for insurance. Either it's your insurance or their insurance. So if the car gets wrecked, it, you know, someone's going to have to cover the insurance, or you know, it's going to come out of pocket on your own. So there's already a system to handle that. Now, it does sound great in theory to, you know, let's just say if the car goes too fast, a governor would slow it down. I think that would be more ethical to have the governor, like, have a machine that would actually slow the car down, kind of like how you can, like, if you do cruise control, there, you can press a button up or down, at least on my car, that'll make it go faster or slower without me pressing the gas pedal. So there is a way to control the car to slow it down. But the way that they chose to do this charge of $150, to me, is a little bit excessive. I think that most likely, even if the person gets an accident or not, he's still going to be paying for the speeding. You see what I'm saying?
Right. When he actually only should be charged if he actually damages the property.
Correct.
Now, going in excess of 90 miles per hour, the car is made to do that. So unless it's damaging the car, he shouldn't be fined for it if he's doing it in a reasonable and prudent manner, which he was, because he didn't have any repercussions except for their, you know, equipment detected that he was going too fast, in their opinion. But he was able to pull it off, so he should be able to do it.
What they're doing is taking the law into their own hands, right? I mean, if you speed and a cop catches you, they make you pay.
But to me, it's...
Why would they do that?
I really don't even think they're trying to take the law into their own hands. I think they're just found a new way to grab some more money.
Yeah, it's all about money. I mean, if you read the guy's little PR spiel in there, it says they're worried about, like, the welfare of other people or whatever. But if you read further, then it says the only thing that warned them was a little thing on top. Let's say there was a GPS in the car, and as a lot of you probably know, GPS can mean anything. It can mean you're just tracking the position in case you get lost. There's no reason to assume it's measuring your velocity. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, there's no way he could have possibly known that when he signed the contract even. And it was on, he did it through a debit card, so they took the $450 out of his account directly. So basically, it was like he had to pay the penalty without a trial, which even in the court system, you get a trial, you know.
And see, because you could say that the equipment was faulty. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, for photo radar, they actually have to go through this huge checking, testing system that's built on it to make sure everything's working correctly. And if it doesn't, it shuts down and it won't even work. They should. I mean, what if the guy didn't have $450 in his account? What if that made him bounce three other checks, and then he had to pay $15 in each check that he bounced? I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And truthfully, if they're going to do that, if they're going to go that route, which I don't even think they should tell you right up front and make sure that they verbalize it and make sure that you're, you know, awake, looking at them in their face, listening to them say, if you drive past this amount, because they can't tell what the posted limit is in that thing. They can just tell what the car is doing. That you will be charged for this. I guarantee you, knowingly, he would have not done that.
Well, actually, it would be really easy for them to create a little system where, during sections of the road wherever the speed limit is, have a little, or whenever the speed limit changes, it has a little, a little beacon, which then tells the car what the speed limit is, and then which will change the governor, will not allow you to go over it.
They could
do
it, but they haven't.
All speed limit is gone.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, there could be a max of 75 miles per hour, and it wouldn't go past that.
But if everything's going that way anyway,
I think that'd
might
be
as
cheaper.
Well, automize the steering so that there's no danger of getting in an accident, and then just let the speed limit be, you know, 150 miles per hour.
Yeah, see, that's a whole lot easier. And people would pay out the for that kind of a
privilege.
Well, if you think about it, I think the governor would be a much cheaper idea because you don't have to link to a satellite. You don't have to pay. I'm sure they pay for a service, a satellite GPS service, to pick up that information. If they had a governor basically on the car and buy cars that were capable of, you know, doing that, maybe there's something with the computer or how that car works that it wouldn't be functional on that. But and I think most cars would be, is that they have some sort of device on there. So I think that, I don't know, I hear too many stories like this.
I don't know. Here you go. If you want to screw with the company, go rent one of their cars. Go on a speed, like a racetrack. Go, like, you know, 120 miles per hour. Make sure you have no money in their account. Then write about 20 checks. So they deduct money until they ruin your account and then sue their butts off because you didn't break any laws.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah.
I like
so
that.
So you never said we couldn't take your car and see what it does in a quarter mile. So.
Yeah, it only costs like $16 or so to like go down to PIR and race in a quarter mile.
Does it say a car can't go past a certain speed no matter what, or it can't go past a certain speed on...
past the speed limit.
The article says the posted speed limit, but I don't think you can determine what the posted speed limit is.
How would they know that?
Yeah, they're just guessing because they can't tell. I mean, like Brian said, they could make a technology where they could, but right now they can't. So I guess they just assume there's no speed limit over 90. Which
yeah, there is some speed limit over 90, except on like special places like race tracks and road tracks.
Actually, in Arizona, I think due to all the import drag racing, if you speed over 85, they automatically put you in jail for a night if they catch you. Any car doing over 85. I think that's good. Most cars don't really need to go over 85.
Yeah, if you're going over 85 and somebody comes in your path, forget it. There's nothing you can do.
So, well, here's something that talks about kind of one of those little gray areas that kind of gives you some sense of freedom. That people are doing with the DirecTV. Let me read it just straight from the article. It seems that you can now connect your DirecTV receiver to a Linux box using TCP/IP to connect across the internet and emulate a valid DirecTV account, enabling all channels. Oh yeah, of course it's open source. Full story, the DTV hackers, this means that you don't have to have an access card at your physical location. You don't have to be located, it can be located across the country, or yet, given another country, period. This seems that one more step towards the fabled digital convergence. So this is basically you take a DirecTV box. They ported it out. I forget what cable they use. But they basically hook it up to your Linux box and take the... I think maybe they might just do it from a TV tuner card or something like that with some special program and basically stream it out. So... let's just say, you know, if you want to have DirecTV to, I guess, your whole house or even your neighbor's house, you would just need one box and a nice little network, and you could just stream it all over you want to. Or if you're on vacation, then you got a nice, T1 connection, and you're off, somewhere else, and you can go to your website and, go to your secret page and pull out your television. You can watch, DirecTV.
There you go.
But is it still able to change channels? That's what I'm kind of wondering about.
Yeah, I think the software is what they have to change the channels. There's actually a website where I read all about this, but I don't have the website with me right now, so I'm not sure where it was.
Because I thought with DirecTV, to actually have another TV hooked to it, you actually had to have another dish.
Well, this basically takes the dish, streams it to a server, and then spreads it out through the internet via the TCP/IP protocol.
Yeah, but it's actually the dish, which is getting like a relay from the box, which tells it what channel to pick up.
I think with...
Okay, I'm not sure that if the dish...
Are you talking about two people viewing different channels at the same time?
Yes.
I'm not sure about that. I didn't see anything about that in the article, but...
Because otherwise you're only streaming one channel through the server.
Unless you make like 100 streams.
Yeah, but then,
unless you can
then
take
the dish could actually be relaying the channels at once, and I don't think that they actually have that capability, because otherwise you wouldn't need to have a dish per TV.
Well, I think that it can, because if it could only send one channel at a time, and then you basically said, oh, switch to another channel, you have no device that shoots something back out, via the phone line or the internet or... back out the satellite. It doesn't shoot a signal back out to the skies and say, give me channel 5.
I'm talking to the dish itself to actually what band to receive.
Oh.
Or to let through.
Okay. I'm really not sure.
Yeah, because I don't know what that technology is.
My impression is that it can get all channels, and basically you can just filter which one you want.
Okay, if that's how it works, then yeah, you could do that fairly easily.
So... So that'd be pretty cool. It's just another little fun thing that people, you know, do with technology, like taking your, TiVo. Taking TiVo, I think they've hacked into TiVo, and basically TiVo's a Linux machine with a hard drive, and they've hacked in, mounted that hard drive, and basically you can take your videos and put them, take the videos that you recorded, and now you have that video, you know, in form of data, which I guess would be great for pirating, because you know, send it all over the internet.
Well, who was the guy who made his own decoder for, I think it was one of those satellite cable type companies. He made his own decoder, and he published how he did it, which, when you think about it, was completely legal, because basically, they're sending rays into his house that he never asked for, and he made a thing that converts it into a TV show, so there was really nothing expressly illegal about that. And then he had a magazine, I read about this on 2600, and they, like, the company, like, sued his butt off, and he didn't afford a lawyer, and they canceled his magazine and everything.
Yeah, I forget the magazine was. It was
Satellite News.
Satellite News, yeah, I read the whole story. I actually heard the show, the 2600 show that he was on, talking about that he just published this information that other people had known that he didn't even figure out in the first place. Somebody else actually figured it out. Basically, the company, as always, targeted the person that they thought would, you know, set the biggest example, even if this person didn't even do something illegal. And they targeted him and told him to cease and desist with his magazine. I guess this reason was, you know, big enough to coerce the courts into making that happen. And they hold a $400,000 legal, like, indictment or something like damages that they can collect on that at any time. If any damages... Okay, basically, if there's any damages of loss of product or sales because of this this publication of this story, they could use that against them, saying, okay, see, here's proof that we lost money here, with a max of $400,000 that they can collect from him, even though he does not have that money at all.
How can they say, though, you know, who owns what waves? You know, how do... They can't say that.
I know, they send it into your house.
Yeah, that's not
actually
fair.
Actually, I think we've talked about this before, is we the people do. We own all the airwaves. All the companies actually just lease it from us, but yet we pay for it, at least in this country. And that's what's really, you know, actually screwy about a lot of things that have gone on.
Well, I don't get it. Then why would this guy get sued?
Because it's just, okay, we talked about this before, and basically 2600 had published a story about the fact that there was a code called DCSS that was created, not by 2600, but yet another individual in another country, just for his own reasons, for the fact that there was not an open source Linux DVD player. In order to read the encrypted DVDs, you'd need an algorithm like this. So there's many reasons that people wanted to create an algorithm. Well, this was published sized on 2600 site. They also found out that the MPAA was going around and making sure that people didn't have it on their website, and basically telling them to take it off their website, saying that they couldn't even link to another person's website. And once again, you know, they're stepping into your front door and telling you that you can't play with something that you paid for and figure it out. You know, 2600.com, they weren't selling decrypted DVDs. They weren't pirating DVDs. They didn't even support that kind of thing. But that's exactly what happened to this person, is that he publicized that story as well. And they just targeted him because it's kind of a PR thing.
It's all about prosecuting the person with the most visibility.
Yeah, the most visibility. So, I mean, if you got some guy in Utah that's doing it in his backyard with his huge 30-foot antenna, you know, and he's doing whatever he's doing back there, okay, so you got rid of him, but they basically didn't scare the other guys that are going to be trying to do the same thing. So they target these individuals. Which, for some reason, to me, obviously, if I was an educated person and I was a judge, I would notice clear out that this is the only reason why this person was targeted. And basically, what we talked about before is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is you're not allowed to reverse engineer certain things. If you reverse engineer it, you're breaking a law. So if I figure out how a DVD works, I'm breaking the law, which doesn't make sense. It's like, okay, so if everything falls under that reasoning, okay, so if I go and all these things are being, like, thrown into like junkyards over time, and it's, you know, it's a couple decades later, and I go into a junkyard and I like, you know, kind of like Junkyard Wars. They go in there and they take these things and they figure out how they work and they piece them together just for hobby. They make something new out of it. They make a modification. They don't like that. If you do anything like that, it's illegal. But there was no harm intended in the first place.
Well, then 90% of all patents are also illegal, because most of them are, you know, like there's one that essentially is like the archetype of them all.
And then they build off of it.
Right. Is you can actually go through and like look through all, you know, patents for a certain type of machine, and you'll see just a plethora of different modifications or, you know, mutations of it.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that what I can't remember? It was some motorcycle company from Japan did to try to simulate Harley sound. So, you know, they kind of reverse engineered the.
Oh, it's the Shadow, I do believe.
I don't remember it, but they got in trouble for that.
Yeah, because Harley actually copyrighted.
Yeah.
Or trademark
the sound.
It seems many people are going along this lines of thinking that, okay, basically the reason for the crackdown on the way the DMCA was written is to protect themselves, which they say is to protect the people and their works, but the only one really making the money in the first place is, you know, the higher ups. It's not the guy writing the movies for the DVDs. It's not the people producing the television. You know, if it's your own like television channel, it's not like the individuals producing the television shows. It's the bigger corporate networks that are making the money. Well, that they're saying, basically my point was they wanted to protect their interests, but they're really not trying to protect their interests. That's a little bit deeper issue. But the thinking that people are going along and doing is that they're trying to dig deeper and have more laws and rules to control how things are used. And it's the same thing with the Microsoft case. Not the case, but the Microsoft story earlier that they're cracking down on the Windows XP and Office XP installations. And that's, you know, people are used to being able to do that. It's kind of a little perk, I guess, to be able to have the freedom to still do little things like that. I think the more people do this, the more it's making the gap between richer and poorer much larger. It's the gap between being free and not being, which is basically, you know, the richer and the poorer. You're going to have to work harder, make more money to be on top of all these guidelines and all these stringents and to be able to enjoy yourself. You can't sit around your house and take apart something or, you know, play with something or do something on the internet that will be considered an illegal operation, you know.
Well, here's something to follow for a future show. There was a guy, I believe he's out in New Mexico, actually built his own rocket ship.
Oh, yeah, I read that.
That will fly him up. I think it's, I don't know, it's really high, but it's not quite to the definition of the end of the atmosphere, so he won't technically be going into space. But it's this big rocket. He actually built it. He had, like, engineers, like, designing it, help him design it and everything. And he's going to go up, and right now he's arguing with the FAA, and, like, he wanted to go up in the desert. He's arguing with, like, the Ecological Society, like, trying to go up. And
but
I'm wondering if they're
going to go up whenever they want.
Huh?
Well, I'm not arguing with what you said, but NASA can go up whenever they want. Why?
Yeah, exactly. Like, his argument, he said, they can't tell me, like, they don't own the sky. Like, I don't know. We're going to have to wait and see what happens with that one.
I don't know. I would be afraid, see, if I were government, I'd be worried for the people, because if everyone started doing that, you know, eventually there's going to be quite a few of them that make some crappy rocket that explodes and kills people, you know, or goes into a...
Was it?
Nah. Well, actually, I do believe that was the Challenger.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the teacher on board, no doubt.
Yeah, what color were her eyes?
Blue.
Actually,
I'm glad I didn't actually have to say the punchline of that joke.
Yeah, me too.
Actually, I'm going to go back to this Microsoft article about XP, where they kind of talk about the people side. Okay. Well, there are three big problems with Microsoft's sudden decision to start enforcing this policy, especially in this draconian fashion. First, the company has never really educated home users about the one PC policy for Windows, like not educating your driver that he's going to give you a ticket if you go past 90. Sure, it's fine in print, but few people read that. Microsoft has extensive programs to educate corporations about the policy, but in the 10 years of reviewing Windows, I can't remember a single major Microsoft consumer ad campaign devoted to the topic. As I'm writing this, I'm holding my hand holding in my hand a colorful cardboard sleeve containing a copy of Windows 98. Nowhere does it say for use on a single PC. Even now, Microsoft isn't preparing the public for the coming crackdown. I'm sure that the majority of multiple PC families have been buying a single copy of each version of Windows and installing it on all their PCs. I'm equally confident that that few of them did so to cheat Microsoft. Microsoft calls this behavior casual privacy, but it called it the natural practice of people who don't know better. But I call it the natural practice of people that don't even know better. Second, Microsoft, plus they charge too much anyways. I think that if you had installed it three times, you'd probably get your money's worth. Second, Microsoft is discriminating against home users in favor of corporate consumers, as it often does. The company offers large consumers bulk purchases of Windows at volume prices. In many cases, these corporate bulk purchasers won't even be subjected to activation. But Microsoft has no plans to offer home users a special 2 or 3 pack of Windows XP for, say, $50 or $75 more than the single copy price. In fact, the company doesn't even plan to allow a person who mistakenly tries to activate a second PC to buy another license over the phone or internet. Finally, Microsoft has chosen a method of enforcing its policy that smacks on invasion of privacy. The company says its database of PC configurations won't contain any personal information and will be encrypted so that nobody can misuse it. But Microsoft's bully boy behavior in the marketplace hardly inspires confidence that it won't somehow exploit this information. So bear all this in mind when you consider whether to upgrade your home to PC, your home PC to Windows XP, especially if you are have more than one computer. The upgrade may cost more than you expected, both in dollars and lost in privacy.
Okay, can I ask you something?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, why do I want to buy Windows XP instead of just keeping Windows 95?
There's no reason.
Like, what possible advantage? Like, that is ridiculous. They're really giving you so much of a reason not to buy it.
There's a really crappy user interface. The new one's all colorful and does all this stupid stuff. It's more dummied down, more wizards. I think it's a bunch of crap. I use Linux.
It's a way to attract people to use their product by threatening you. All right.
Because they know you have to buy it. See, that's the idea. Now
exactly.
But even if you didn't have to buy it, because you don't, that's how they think.
Well, the good news is that their eventual downfall is certain with logic like that. So,
with Linux and the new Macintosh OS 10, I'm really, really happy about that. So, hopefully balance will come. Okay, move on to another story that's kind of different from everything we've been talking about. It's kind of funny as well. First, there was a computer virus. Now, scientists have found a fungus that eats compact disks. Victor Cardenis of Spain, leading scientific research body, stumbled across a microscopic creature 2 years ago. While visiting Belize, friends complained that in the hot and sticky Central America climate, its CD stopped working and had developed an odd discoloration that left parts of it virtually transparent. Dr. Cardenis and colleagues at the Superior Council for the Scientific Research in Madrid discovered a fungus that steadily was eating through the supposedly indestructible disk. The fungus had burrowed into the CD from the outer edge, then devoured the thin aluminum layer and some of the data storing polycarbonated resin. Dr. Cardenas said it completely destroys the aluminum. It leaves nothing behind. Biologists at the council had never seen this fungus, but concluded that it belonged to a common genus called Jetarichum, Jetarichum. Jetarichum. Philips and Dutch electronics companies invented the disc said it believed that the Belize case was probably a freak incident caused by extreme weather conditions.
Puff Daddy.
Actually, that has some other connotations as well. Now, if that thing eats aluminum, what all, like, really common things do we use that are aluminum?
Planes?
Yeah.
Trains, automobiles?
All that.
Well, it could be just a small portion. You know what I mean? It depends on the bulk of the aluminum that has a small amount of aluminum.
Well, if it can eat any aluminum.
And they reproduce exponentially, so they reproduce.
Right, and so it would eventually grow and grow and grow until it could eat any size.
The world!
Yeah, like all aluminum in the world.
Your family.
Sci-fi movie coming to your theater. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the fungus which eats aluminum.
But that Starship Troopers, is that kind of what they are? that big colony of bugs that they go around and destroy all the time? That was a stupid movie. Okay.
Movie review of the week.
Movie review of the week.
Speak on it.
Speak on it. Okay. here's another story about the 210 megahertz transistor that IBM's developed. IBM has redefined its silicon germanium chip manufacturing technology to produce transistors that are far thinner than others. As a result, information can travel faster at the same speed using far less power. The new transistor is capable of operating at 210 gigahertz using just 1 milliamp of electrical current, or just about 80% faster than current technology while using half as much power. IBM said that the technique should pave the way for networking chips that can run on 80 gigahertz, or twice as fast as today's fastest silicon-based chips. If successful, IBM could help chip designers avoid having to move more of their processors to more exotic materials such as gallium, G-A-L-L-I-U-M, arsenide, or indium phosphide. Silicone just wasn't going to go to those speeds, said IBM Bernard Mayerson, who also is vice president of the company's communications research and development center in East Fishkill, New York. In a nutshell, we've raised the bar dramatically. IBM has been a leader in blending germanium and silicon atoms to produce a material that conducts electricity more efficiently than pure silicon. Though IBM has been working with silicon germanium for about a decade, the latest advance allows the company to make transistors the building blocks of chips that are only 100 atoms to 200 atoms thick at the base. That's what really makes this work, Mayer said. The first chips to use the new technology will likely be network chips that help guide data on and off of high-speed fiber optic lines. When operated at low power levels, the chips could also find their way into cell phones, particularly for radio components. So that's pretty cool.
That's pretty small. 100 atoms, that's like invisible, isn't it?
To my eye.
I hope they don't lease those.
Pay your monthly dues.
Yeah.
So, definitely. The only thing is that they may work that fast. It's developing boards that will be able to work with speeds, work at those speeds as well. Okay, let's see.
At one point, you even need, like, more speed. Not the drug, Joel. I know you're... Dimitri.
So, yes. Okay.
Joel's our intern here at the show.
Joel's our intern. Joel keeps...
Hi.
Fetch me some coffee, Joel.
Hi.
Joel keeps all the... Joel keeps this whole system up and running here.
Yeah. Fetch Dimitri some coffee.
Fetch Dimitri.
I'll get you coffee.
All right. Well, the next... It's another story on speed, but it's more on the web server side of things. In a case of eWeeks Labs web server benchmark, Red Hat Inc.'s Tux 2.0 web server running on Linux 2.4 kernel has taken performance far beyond the previously possible and blazes the way for future web servers built on the same architecture. In a test performed at eWeek Labs, we working closely with Dell Computer Corporation's Performance Engineer Group, the original group that first publishes Tux's amazing performance benchmarks on the SpecWeb 99 benchmark, and I'll explain more about what Tux is in a minute, found that Tux was able to perform nearly three times faster than current web server mainstay Apache, 12,792 transactions per second versus 4,602 transactions per second while running a mix of dynamic and static web page content. Basically, what Tux is it's Red Hat's, I believe it's Red Hat's, I think it's just Linus Talbard's. It comes with the 2.4 kernel. And what Tux does is, if you have your own web server, you can run Tux on top of your web server. And basically, if you're running like Apache, and then a file comes in, or a request for data comes in. So it says, I want index.html. Well, Apache gets that information, then forwards it on to the kernel and says, can I please have this file? It says, you have permission to have the file. You may take the file. Apache then takes the file and then sends the file out. The way Tux works is it's built directly into the kernel. So what happens is that even if you're running Apache, when a request for like a page, let's say index.html comes in, Tux will be there to intercept that information. It'll basically see it before Apache does and says, you want page? You got page. And it sends it straight back out, and you don't have to go through the other process of getting that out there. So it's a pretty cool toy, and it's real easy to set up. Well, not a toy. It's a useful utility. program, and it's really easy to set up, and it comes with all 2.4 kernels, so I definitely recommend using it. There are some, read a little bit about it before you set it up. There are some things where it can cause, you know, things not to work correctly if you set it up incorrectly. So read it, how to set it up correctly before you do so. Here's another cool story about PlayStation 2s. Read straight from the article here. In Salzburg, Australia, people in developing nations could soon be using modified Linux game consoles equipped with satellite links to help them learn more about vital health issues. The project, sponsored by Western and Asian business leaders, worked through the World Economic Forum, WEF, aims to narrow the so-called digital divide. With all the businesses of the world together, we can link all of the poor countries, the schools, hospitals, and health clinics of the poor countries, and get them all on the net. This helps enormously. For example, in sending information about AIDS, says John Gage, one of the founders of WEF Committee on the Digital Divide, in an interview at the WEF European Economic Summit here Tuesday. Developing nations have said they need IT as much as they need, for example, clean water. According to Gage, I don't agree with that, chief researcher of Sun Microsystems, in this last year for the first time, you had agreed amongst all the poor countries that internet and IT is a fundamental component of development. 2 or 3 years ago, you would probably go to a meeting and people would say, we don't even have clean water. How do you think we can think about IT, says Gage. The ITC, Information and Communication Technology governors of the WF, represent about 70% of technology companies driven the project. The committee includes members from Cisco Systems, John Chambers, 3Com, Eric Benhow, and Hewlett-Packard's Carly Fiorina. The ideal device for the project would be Sony's PlayStation console, according to Gage. The console already supports Linux and Sun's Java programming language. In addition, a hard disk can be connected to the device using the IEEE 1394 FireWire port.
That's PS2, right?
Yep. And let's see. The PlayStation is $300 with DVD player, and it runs Linux and Java. It's huge. Why wouldn't you ever put a PC someplace? It breaks all the time. You would spend more time fixing it than teaching it. So basically, teaching how to use it. So you pay $300, and basically they're going to come out in Japan. I think it's $150 for the Japanese hard drive. I think it's a 40-gig hard drive. You can plug it in that port that's in the back of the PlayStation 2. Linux hasn't come out in the American market for the PlayStation 2, and I think it just came out in the, only in Japan. And there's also, I think it comes with two USB ports and the IEEE port. And basically, yeah, you could connect it to a satellite device and communicate amongst others. So you have a free operating system, you have a $300 PC. The only thing you're missing is a monitor, which could basically be any, you know, say even a 14-inch television. And I think it's great. I think it's a lot of people, you know, didn't realize. And you can do the same thing with the Xbox, too, that discussed in the article. But I think there's a lot of things you can use a machine like that for. So it's pretty interesting. I'm kind of crazy about is the Xbox when it comes out. JP, do you know what it's supposed to be? Like $300?
Yeah, for retail, it's $300.
So the thing that's crazy about that is that just to buy the GeForce 3 card, which is basically what runs the Xbox as far as the graphics, in stores for a PC is $400.
I don't know if it's the same card or anything, but yeah, they take a big hit every time they sell a system. I don't know about Xbox, but PS2, they were losing. It was ridiculous. They were losing like $350 on every system they sold.
Really?
And they hope to make it back in software licensing. Like, say Capcom wants to make a PS2 game, then Sony will say, like, okay, you give us 10%, or $10 usually it is, on whatever every copy you sell. And they hope to make it back that way. But I don't know. It doesn't really bode too well for their profits margin, which doesn't really matter to, like, say you're buying games. It doesn't really matter to you, except for eventually the system will go out of business like Dreamcast. Because basically it works out to, they're only going to make a profit if every person who buys a PS2 buys 15 games, which is really unlikely given that a lot of people bought it, especially as a DVD player. So that doesn't bode well for them. And it's the same thing for any
system. It's a tough industry, just like Xbox. They're probably taking a big hit on every system they sell. They're going to have to sell a lot of software to make it up. So yeah, they actually are losing a lot of money on every system they sell.
Are you sure it's $350?
That might be slightly exaggerated, but it's, I know for a fact. It's,
I know they are losing money, but...
it might be as low as $150, but something in the...
$150.
Yeah, that might be right.
For the Xbox, it's kind of crazy. It comes with, I think it's 64 megs of RAM, and it comes with a Pentium, I think it's a 700 or a 733 or 750. It's basically a PC, and the thing to me is I don't even know why you'd want to buy an Xbox. I don't even know why Xbox is created. It doesn't seem economic. Basically, what Microsoft could do is basically coordinate the making of games for a PC that meets certain requirements, and people could develop games like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they're just trying to bust into the console market, but yeah, you're right. It's totally inefficient.
It doesn't make sense to me.
And think about GameCube. That's only 200, and that thing's pretty powerful itself. It's kind of like a Gecko chip in there or something. Or
the GameCube is going to rock.
Yeah.
And
check out GameSpot.com for a preview on that.
Yeah, the games, actually, the games, the lineup of the games for the GameCube are pretty, pretty nice.
Yeah, that's pretty strong. And I don't know, Xbox had a little bit of a disappointing appearance at E3. People weren't exactly awed by their games coming out, but I guess give them a chance to impress us until the system comes out. They're both coming out in November. I think GameCube hits November 5th, and then Xbox is November 8th. So
yeah, just before it.
Yeah. So we'll have to wait and see on those.
Actually, I think that's pretty smart of them to put it just before Xbox.
Oh, yeah, very smart.
Because if you want to go out and say, you know what I mean? Like, okay, you want to go out, you want to get your game system, you don't know which one to choose, you don't care, you're crazed. Might as well get the first one that comes out.
I know. It's like, should I wait 3 days and spend another $100 or get this really cool one that everybody else is buying where there's all these good games I want to play right now? Let's see. I don't know.
Yeah. So. All right. How you doing over there, VR?
Oh, just dandy.
Dandy? Have you been reading anything interesting lately?
Wow, that's quite a broad question there.
What about what you're looking at last month we were talking about? Basically colors.
Oh yeah, color theory.
Color theory. I think you would discuss that, but we didn't have time.
Oh yeah, well that's there's a guy in the Dinshaw, you know, they created the Dinshaw Society back in the early 1900s that was actually using the healing qualities of light to treat ailments. Like one of the more shocking examples of how actually effective it is that there's this 12-year-old child that was burned over 80% of its body.
It's.
Because I don't remember if it was
it
a
became an
boy or girl.
It got burned that much.
Yeah.
It
just became a thing. But because it's very inhuman. But they wanted to get it, you know, they needed to get its like metabolism going, and it wasn't excreting any bodily fluids, let's put it that way. And so one of the nurses in the hospital was actually trained in spectrochrome, which is his whole color paradigm. And so what she did is she took a violet light actually shined it on the kidney areas for about 15 seconds. Within about 45 minutes, the child actually like urinated. And it's just...
Wow, where can I get that?
Yeah, I know. I'm having a hard time micturbating. Can you shine some light on my kidneys?
But yeah,
you touch a violet light over my bed at night.
No. Then you'd want more like an indigo.
That's at night.
That's a different color.
Maybe like
a bodily fluid.
Maybe like a new prank at camp. Instead of like putting shaving cream on their hand, and they make them grab their face.
Or putting the hand in cold water.
You wake up and there's five people huddling over you with a light.
Give you a UV flashlight, man.
And that's something that the cops would use on you when they pull you over. They just flash that light on you and.
You just cease and...
I think it was
George Carlin that said that one thing you will never see is a man running down the street full speed and actually fecalating.
Defecating,
there you go.
Defecating.
You mean sneezing?
I'm going to prove him wrong.
I don't know how we got on the subject, but you know, like, I guess I'll continue with this one. I think it's proof that you can't sneeze and urinate at the same time.
Oh, yes. That is odd.
Now, who actually experimented with that?
I don't know.
It had to be rather messy. Rather messy.
For a second, I thought you were going to talk about the four-color theorem, which is the theory that no matter what map you could make, as long as it's a two-dimensional map, obviously, you'll never need more than four colors, like, if you don't want two different countries that are touching at the same color. And, like, it seems really simple, but nobody's been able to prove it. The only proof ever made was, like, a 5,000-page paper that was, like, made by computers, and nobody's ever checked it, because nobody ever wanted to read it. But glad you didn't talk about that,
because
that would be boring.
That would be really... Actually, well, that would depend on the country's borders.
Yeah, but no matter what map you make, it'd be impossible to need more than four colors.
Four colors. So there's no country which is bordered by five countries.
Well, it can be bordered by all of them.
Oh, actually.
Yeah, because that country could be red, say, in the middle.
Yeah.
And then you could have green, blue, yellow, green, blue, yellow, green, blue, yellow.
Right around it.
Yeah.
For some reason, I keep thinking of the Risk map when you guys talk about this.
Wow.
Food for thought.
Food for thought. Yes.
Speak on it.
Speak on it. All right. Well, JP, you had a story that I had handed to you that you kind of read about.
Yeah, this is about quantum cryptology. It's kind of interesting here. Let me just read a few excerpts. Modern cryptography, such as that employed in a widely used program, PGP, which stands for Pretty Good Privacy. Yes, that's actually what it stands for. Relies on the mathematical manipulation of data. To encrypt or lock a message, the program performs a series of mathematical steps on it, using a number more than 100 digits long, or in some cases way longer than that. Only that number's correct mate, or the key, is able to undo those steps and unlock it. That's just standard encryption stuff here. Now this guy Richard Hughes, he's the leader of a team at Los Alamos. He thinks that using photons of the quantum theory, photons are the quantum theory of light, basically. Some people think light's a wave, some people think it's a particle, but the particles would be called photons. He thinks that using those, you can manufacture and distribute keys that would correct the weaknesses in basic cryptography. Those weaknesses are essentially that somebody can get their hands on the key, they can decrypt the message. So basically, it relies on the fact that individual photons possess properties that are governed by one of the basic laws of quantum mechanics, the uncertainty principle, which is essentially that you can never know the exact location and direction of a photon, sort of like Heisenberg uncertainty principle for electrons. It's kind of hard to explain technically, but essentially if you measure it, if you look at it and try and define where it is, just measuring it will in fact change its location. So it's kind of like a loop. No matter what you do, you can never know. Now, the way it works basically is that this feature of photons means that they can be used to construct a single-use, self-destructing key rather than like sort of like an envelope in a spy movie that explodes when they get it. So basically the sender and the recipient must arrange to open a channel for sending the photons. The first person, let's call him Allison Bob, makes a string of photons. They measure everything about it, and then they send it off to the second guy, Bob. Bob will measure it, and then in any way he chooses. And now they both have the decryption, right? Now the brilliance of it is that if anybody tries to intercept it and study it, then it'll be destroyed, because if you measure it, it's destroyed. So once these two people have it, nobody can break it, even if they theoretically have like a quantum computer that can move at any speed. Because no matter what they do, if they try to study the key is destroyed. And they can't copy it either, because by copying it, they'd have to measure it. So basically, there's just this one code, and nobody can intercept it. So basically, it eludes any prospect, which I think is pretty amazing. Like, it's a brilliant idea. And in theory, like, they could do it. They've actually already done something like it through optical fiber. Now they're trying to do it through open space, so they're going to see if they can do that.
I'm not quite sure of that.
What do you mean?
Well, my thing is that after, like, Alice measures it and Bob measures it, it would have to affect the photons. The second time he measures it? Exactly the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
Every time. And so, and because it's working on the Hindenburg...
Heisenberg
uncertainty principle, that even in the electron cloud, it's just a field where
it might be.
So by measuring it, it's changing it. So like it would have to change the same way every time when Alice measures it to when it gets to Bob to measure it. It's in the same place that he measured it the first time, so it affects it the same way. So there's between the two of them, they have a constant, which is actually mind-blowing, because you're essentially getting two different, like a constant twice, from several different uncertainties or unknowables.
Yeah. Are you kind of like thinking out loud on how you could make that work?
You're trying to kind of explain how.
Well, this is just how I just took that in,
yeah.
Internalized it, thought about how it possibly could work, and to understand it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Exactly. It's pretty technical. You might want to check it out. It's in The Economist. But yeah, essentially, it's kind of brilliant, really. Like, it's a combination of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Not really, because that applies to electrons, but it's the same thing applies to photons. So basically, by the time another person measures it, it doesn't exist anymore. It's really, it has to get down to the fundamental aspects of what these particles do. So the standard concept that's already in use everywhere of cryptology is just, basically, you're factoring really large prime numbers. And say I have a 400-digit number. By the way cryptology works, it's easier for me to encode it than it is for you to decode it. So you have to have a computer way faster than me to decode it. So therefore, no matter whatever the fastest computer in the world is, that computer can encode it, but it cannot decode it until there's a faster computer. That's why cryptology works, except for once in a while, you know, when there's great advances or somebody does a brute force hack with, like, tons of computers, somehow you can break it sometimes. But this is saying, no, it doesn't go by the speed of the computer. It goes by one of the fundamental aspects of one of the fundamental particles of, you know, existence, the fundamental light particle. So it's taking it to a completely separate level, where it's literally physically impossible to decode it, which, I mean, we'll have to see if they get this going, but then, I don't know, that seems like it would pretty much alter drastically, you know, military codes and everything. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Crazy stuff. I had someone similar with Dimitri, and I don't know if this can already be done or not. Dimitri, remember I was talking about setting up your own domain names? Your own top-level domain names?
Yeah, I remember that.
Hasn't somebody done that?
I don't know. See, what I'm thinking, it may be, I'm just hoping somebody out there really, who knows what I'm talking about, doesn't think that, oh, that's really easy. I don't know if it's really easy or it's really hard, so that's kind of something new to me. Basically, it's like, out there they have something that are called root servers. Root servers point you to the top-level domain servers. The top-level domain servers will point you to the hosts that are under those. Like if I want to go to slipnet.org, what I'll do is I'll say, root server, where's the .org servers? And I'll say, well, that's the .org server. And I'll say, .org servers, where's Slipnet? And I'll say, that's where Slipnet is. And then if I had something underneath my domain, another host or another domain, I'd say, hey, Slipnet, where's, land2.slipnet.org? So basically, I was wondering if I could set up a closed network that had my own root servers, and then I had just, which would be pretty cool, which would be just for me and my friends, and then we could like make our own top level domain names that only we could see, which would be, you know, if we wanted to have like you know, .buttkiss, we could have, you know, you could go to jp.buttkiss. So it'd be I don't know. I don't know if it's something that anyone's ever tried. I mean, if anyone's tried it, please email me at slipmode@quest.net or inthenow@quest.net. But it's something that I was thinking about tackling. I could set up, especially with the cable modems and the DSL modems out there, I think that you can set up a pretty high speed, if it's possible, and I think it is very possible, set up a high speed your own DNS structure.
You know, you can set a trusted connection with DNS and give it its own name. So you're in your internal network, you know, you'd say, well, I want to go to bob.com or whatever that doesn't conflict with internet at all, and it'll take you directly to that remote location.
Well, couldn't you also do that by like setting up like not a by doing a dot something else instead of like a dot net,
a
dot org?
You're just talking
about like a dot bob.
Yeah, so it's like an intranet, essentially.
Yeah, but you can also, you know, go across you can have it go across the internet.
Well, I mean, there's ways of doing this where you could actually do routing, where you wouldn't even use really DNS at all. You could use, you would be using DNS, but basically you could do routing where you set up your, to route to these other machines, and then you could also do like a CNAME. Well, you can't do the COM, though. So, explain that again, JP? are not Demetrius, because if you put in the com, it's still going to want to look for something to designate what the com is, or org, or any of the top level domains.
Well, I was just reading something in Linux that was just saying as long as it doesn't interfere with Internic or anything that's already registered out there, then you can use it as your own domain name.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. Basically, if there's nothing out there that says, like Jojo.com, if there's no Jojo.com, you can have Jojo.com, but nobody can point to it unless they already know what the IP address is.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can go to, yeah. But what I'm looking for is if you could go to a browser, and let's just say we have our own Slipnet network that all of us are on and all of our buddies are on, and we host our own private websites, just us. It could be a form of communication. And to make it interesting, I mean, you could do it other ways, but I'm saying just this would be the fun part, is that we would have our own dot somethings. You know, we could have a dot. You can go to jp.jp.
I'm pretty sure you can do that fairly easily.
I don't know if it's a piece of software like a different, like a enhanced version of Bind for the root servers, or basically if I just configure Bind as a root server zone, and the way the network's set up, it doesn't look to any of the root servers for name queries. It looks to our internal root servers for name queries, which is you just basically edit the file of where the root servers are at.
Yeah.
So I think that might be a possibility, but I think it'd definitely be pretty fun to have a trusted connection all across our different homes. That'd be pretty interesting.
Yeah, I wonder how you can do that. I'd like to be able to make a root server.
I mean, I think it's just maybe it's really simple. Maybe you just configure the root server zones to look for a comm server, and basically, or whatever we choose, and then we can have another server that basically is that zone, like the zone, let's just say it's internet, internet. So we can have something .internet. Well, we'd have another computer that handles the internet zone, and in that zone, it could point to other computers. Basically, we'd have to have a couple spare machines that would have to run all the zones, and then take all of our DNS programs. Would probably, if we're all running Linux or something equivalent to a Unix-style machine, we're probably using Bind, and you edit the file that goes out. And I don't know if this is pre-coded into Bind. I believe it is, that actually will go out to this. There's an FTP site, and I forget the name of it, but this FTP site where you can always download the newest version of the root server's file. We'd have to change that to where it would download to our servers, change the root server file to point to our root servers. But I think it'd be pretty fun. I'm surprised I haven't heard of somebody doing it. I don't know if it's the extra money of having the other PCs and the work just for the fun benefit, but people do crazy stuff like port DirecTV on the internet. So maybe it's already been done, maybe not. But it sounds pretty fun.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna head into our last story. Australia bans hacker tools. The IT security industry has been scathing in its attack this week on the Cybercrime Bill 2001, labeling it a draconian and dangerous. Okay, the word was actually stuck together. Under the bill, which proposes several new computer offenses carrying jail terms of up to 10 years, it is legal to possess hacker toolkits, scanners, or virus code. These are tools of the trade for security vendors to test systems, placing a burden on lawyers drafting ethical hacking agreements with corporations. Bernard Hill, barrister and corporate services manager of Canberra-based security consulting 90 East, said that the act complicates the necessary testing undertaking the company, which manages a number of Commonwealth agencies. I'm not quite following the article. I can sum it up once we're done. It's a burden of lawyers. Well, actually, I'll just sum this up right now. Basically, what they're doing is they're banning hacker tools from being in the presence of certain people. I think I can scroll down to the article where there's who they allow to keep it. But I think it's basically keeping these tools out of the public's hands and keeping it in private hands and the private sector's hands, as far as people, security agencies. I mean, you know, your local, if you had a person that did kind of a security consulting agency in town, somebody like that would be able to have it. Of course, the government would be able to have it.
Now, are you sure that that article actually says that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, it does.
I haven't read that.
Oh, yeah.
Because the history that I know of Australia lately with their legislation is throwing the baby out with the bathwater, like their whole outlawing all guns. That now they're actually Olympics sports shooters, can't even own weapons, which that's really kind of... And they had a great upheaval of, you know, an increase of convenience stores being robbed with pitchforks and axes.
Yeah, see, there's a weapon anywhere.
So it's kind of like if you really want to go and, like, take over a country, go to Australia with one gun, and you could probably do it fairly easily.
Yes. Seriously.
Even without bullets.
Yeah, what about, like, security guards and, like, cops?
Oh, they probably don't either.
Jeez.
So go in the police station?
Yeah, I'll take
well,
your money.
If the Olympic sports shooters can't do it, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I've heard of that a lot, but I didn't know if there were exceptions or not. Yeah, that's crazy.
Actually, here, let me read this part. Amendments to the bill that will be debated when Parliament sits again in August, and Hill said 90 East, is preparation of submission identifying these loopholes. In the whole bill. He agreed such tools and information are also required by system administrators to secure electronic infrastructure. The proposed bill does allow the Defense Signal Directorate, DSD, and Australian Security Intelligence Organizations, ASIS, to hack legally. It also forces companies to, by law, to reveal passwords, codes, keys, cryptographic, and steganographic methods used to protect information. Hill said companies may be concerned about intellectual property being compromised, but protecting the national infrastructure is critical. Well, the national infrastructure, I think, is the people as well.
Why would they have to give that up?
That's crazy.
Well, and if only a certain few actually have those tools.
Yeah. That's going to leak out easy.
Yeah, well, and those kinds of tools are actually, you know, people-generated that pretty much anybody, can, if they want to know it, can actually learn it and create them.
Yeah.
So then... there's going to be not that information is going to be available except for those who are going to learn it on their own. So it actually makes their whole infrastructure more susceptible for a few to go in there and wreak large amounts of havoc.
Basically, what I think is going to happen is there'll be more underground. It's going to be well hidden and more strategic. So now, by doing this, basically you're taking all the stupid script kiddies, getting them out the window because now they don't have quick access to programs like that. Okay, fine, you eliminate the script kiddies to do a couple of denial service attacks or stuff like that. So, okay, you got rid of a few of the dummies, but the guys who really know what's going on, they're going to be able to get their hands on these things, and basically they're going to be more strategic, more private, more well thought, and basically now the smarter people are going to stick around.
So it's pretty much the parallel to if you take away the guns, then only the outlaws will have guns.
Yeah. Well, also, they're... that whole attitude is very country-based, while the internet and the information structure is world-based. So here they are, they're going, hi everyone, we're disarming, we're taking away all our precautionary tools and only giving it to a few. So, you know, we're our back door is wide open.
Please come in. I don't know, I think it all has to do with that, like, mythos of, like, what a hacker is, like, the hacker, the punk kid, like, you know, ruining your website or whatever. Like, I once heard someone say the real hackers are, like, the people like The Loft who hack their own computers, who know what they're doing. That's what a hacker is. They're trying to take away the hacker tools. That's just the tools you use to secure your website, to secure your network. How can they take that away? It's
hackers are the frontline soldiers to keeping the infrastructure alive. A real hacker is a frontline soldier to keep the infrastructure alive. Basically, the way these systems are set up and the way things are going is that if you're not constantly testing them, trying to break them, trying to improve them, which is basically what a hacker does, you know, if you break into someone's machine that's restricted, that's illegal, and you're now breaking the law. That's not a hacker. That's a criminal. And these types of tools, okay, morally, you know, you wouldn't want to, of course, you'd, or just intelligently, you'd want only the people who need the tools to have them and not the others. But once again, it's going to be a far cry trying to stop information from getting to people because we've already seen that with the MP3 saga because you know, saying, okay, we're trying to get rid of MP3s on that. It's not going to happen, guys. And I don't even know why they're wasting their time. See, this... Okay, here's another thing that this leads to. I was watching Cops the other day. And granted, what I think they were doing in nature was correct, but in the overall outcome was very not well planned. What they did was they would walk around. They would have one person, let's say, stay on the street or something like that, pretend to sell crack cocaine. As soon as they sell crack cocaine, about five cops would run out of quarter, throw you on the ground, and arrest you. About five cops to get the one crackhead, right, who probably isn't healthy in the first place. So now you're paying five cops, or six, actually it was about seven cops. You're paying seven cops to stand in a corner, pay all of their wages to sell a fake $20 rock of crack rock to a crackhead, arrest him. He'll get in jail for a small period of time, get out, probably pay the city a small fine, and that's it. When, and he said, well, that's just one less crackhead on the streets and it shakes up the dealer's market. Yeah, right, if they take five, if they take ten, maybe if they take only, okay, if they take 10 crackheads, I don't think they're really affecting any dealer. You know how much money these dealers make? And if, yes, you, if you took 20, maybe it would be, maybe be a problem to deal. Basically, it's time not well spent. With the same thing with these hacker tools, is maybe they should, what they should have done is they should crack down and try to be the guy trying to buy the crack rock from the dealer and bust the dealers. And basically, you take his whole everybody.
His whole supply out of the
loop.
Of the demand.
Yeah, out of the demand.
Well, still, like the hacker tools is kind of like you know, outlawing the tools to make fences because they can tear down fences too.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. And then as well is that here's how it works. Even resorting back to what the hacker thing is that okay? Let's just say you arrest this crackhead. Obviously, this person isn't having a good life, anyways. Okay. So he's probably pissed off. So you're going to arrest him, make him more upset, make him more depressed, want his drug even more, and do worse things to get it and be more devious about it.
Right, because there's a Drew Carey joke of, yeah, you hate your job. It's called Everyone. And the support group is called that everybody goes to is called the bar.
Yeah.
So crack is just a different way of dealing with the hatred of reality.
So my point is maybe take that thinking, and instead of trying to steal the tools away from all those people, plus crack and hacker tools are a little different. They cause damage in different areas, and I think they cause far less damage in the computer area. They should try a different approach. I think what they're doing is by far non-productive.
Well, actually, I could see a benefit for crackheads, because that's one more person that has been taken out of the employment pool and just gave me another quarter raise.
Yeah.
Because there's no one else that's willing to do my job.
That's kind of like talking about immigrants, too. Having immigrants come over and doing the jobs that people here don't like doing.
Right.
And they do it pretty well.
That's why the president always, you know, makes a big thing about the present rate of unemployment. Why? Because if unemployment is low, that means the people are getting paid more, because there's less supply of unemployed people to take new jobs, so they have to pay people higher to get the demand for people to come in and take those new jobs.
Correct.
So yeah. It's a whole beautiful little
same
dynamic.
Reason garbage people get a lot of money, or garbage collectors, because nobody else wants to do it.
Yeah, I love the value of employment.
All right, well, that's going to do it for our July edition of In the Now.
In the Now.
It's been a good show. Dimitri?
Good night.
VR?
What color is your day?
JP?
What's up with you?
All right. And I'm Slip Mode, and we'll be seeing you next month, second Friday of the month. Have a good night, good day, or whenever you listen to us, have a good time. Yeah!